Well, we are going to jump right in here to this next section in our study through Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And we're going to be preparing here toward the end of the service to move into a time of communion, so a heads up about that. We can be preparing our hearts and minds for that. And I just want to give a quick disclaimer for this, for the message here. I've prepared for this like I usually do with like an adult audience in mind, or like middle school level and up audience in mind. And let me just say, we have a great, engaging children's ministry experience designed every single week for kids that are like that age, who are younger. And so just a heads up that today, perhaps more than other weeks, you might want to take advantage of that if you have younger kids. I'm not going to say anything inappropriate, I don't think. You never know. But I will say this, we're going to be getting into some things here that may lead to conversations that you might not want to have or be ready to have with your kids. So I'm going to call this sermon, I think, maybe NSFC for not safe for church. So, and don't blame me. Blame Jesus for what he says next in this next part of the Sermon on the Mount, which you actually, if you look ahead, you know what, you know. Okay, so fair warning. I know, now we're all excited. Now we're all curious. Like, what's this going to be? Me too. We'll see. Matthew chapter 5, we're going to pick this up in verse 27. Here we go. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell." So this should be fun, right? Again, you want to take your kids out? Now's a good time. We saw last week how Jesus, when he begins in his sermon, when he begins addressing issues of the heart, when he begins getting down to our character and how do we develop spiritually, our spiritual formation, Jesus begins first, last week, with anger and its twin brother, contempt. Because Jesus knows if you were to pull all unrestrained anger and contempt out of us and out of the world, you've just gotten rid of like the majority of all the wrong things people do to each other. They get carried out. He knows that anger and contempt constantly intermingle and threaten to really spill out on whoever's closest to us, like the people around us, in our words and in our actions. And I think it's amazing that what we looked at last week with anger and contempt, that's every bit as true today as it was back then. It's like, how did he know? Amazing. Then we get to this. I mean, that was heart issue number one. This is issue number two. The second major issue Jesus deals with concerns sex. And of course, he's right on target for today. Like two for two. This guy's, he's really good. So violence, right, which is really an overflow of anger and contempt, and sex are two things that really repeatedly show up as areas of some of our greatest problems. And Jesus, in dealing with sex, just like he does with anger, he starts building his case with one of the Ten Commandments. He starts with something everyone was already familiar with. In this case, he reminds them of the commandment, "You shall not commit adultery." And here, just like with murder, this is an absolute prohibition. In other words, there's no circumstances under any conditions in which murder or adultery, where it's right. But of course, Jesus doesn't stop there. As we've seen with murder, the mere fact that you don't murder someone you're in a relationship with doesn't mean your relationship with that person is good, is as it should be. And the same thing here. Just because you don't commit adultery doesn't mean your relationship is as it should be, that you are, you yourself, where you ought to be with reference to your sexuality. So Jesus is addressing all of us, but it kind of sounds like he's addressing men, since he mentions men specifically. But he's addressing individuals who thought of themselves as good, as right, in their sexual life because they didn't do the specific thing forbidden in the commandment. Again, they're like those from last week who thought they were right in their relationships because they hadn't killed people. Jesus, pretty smart guy, would you agree? Yes, thank you. But he was aware, as we can easily notice today, that some of the very same people who thought of themselves as virtuous and righteous in their actions, you know, because they avoided the big sins, but these very same people would follow a woman with their eyes, like leering, basically devouring her with a lustful gaze, fantasizing about what the actual act would be like. And Jesus here is teaching that a person who cultivates lusting in this way is not the kind of person who's at home in the goodness of the kingdom of God. Now, obviously, we live in a sex-obsessed culture. From TV shows to movies to advertising to our music to the magazines at the checkout aisle. I mean, sex, it's everywhere, isn't it? Has anybody else noticed that, or is that me? And we've become, this is true, we've become so desensitized to sexual imagery that advertisers have to use provocative images just to get our attention. And so it's used to sell everything from, again, shampoo to beer to banking. Everything apparently hinges on sexuality as the thing that sells it. And that's to say nothing of the growth of the prevalence of pornography, and there's all kinds of statistics on that that are really alarming, and not just coming from like church people or religious people, but from like brain scientists and mental health professionals about the effects of that. I've told you this before, but C.S. Lewis, he gave a short parable to kind of get it at our obsession in this area, and I'll tell it again because I think it really is worth thinking about. He said, suppose you visit another country, and you found that in this country, they could fill a whole theater of people just by doing this, just by someone walking out on the stage with a covered plate, with a lid, that they slowly opened up to reveal a steak or some bacon. And you watched from the back in amazement as everyone in this moment sat tantalized on the edge of their seat. Now, if you saw something like that, would you not think that something had gone wrong in this particular country with people's appetite for food? Like something that would be weird, right? His argument is, would anyone else not think it, you know, from our world, not think it equally strange the way that our culture obsesses in similar ways over sex? And a lot of times, the church is silent on this. We don't know how to address this, either because of our own failings in this area or because we don't want to come across as like prudish or puritanical or not with the times. And so for sure, there are Christians and Muslims and Jews and even people who aren't religious but are morally concerned. We've tried to stand against our culture and maintain that things like sexual purity or chastity or fidelity are really, really important. But here's the problem. We come to church and we sing songs and we pray prayers and we set our mind on things above, right? And then we go home and watch a football game. We're exposed to dozens of commercials and ads, you know, advertising upcoming shows that are full of sex and violence. Now, I think it's fascinating then that Jesus, the first two things that Jesus mentions are these. And again, we've been saying the order of this is really important. I think the reason is because Jesus knows that addressing these two things are like at the very foundation of establishing his character within us. The other fascinating thing to me about this is when you look at the two things Jesus starts with, anger, contempt, violence, and sex, those aren't necessarily immediately like about us and our relationship with God. Who are they about? Other people. About our relationships with others, how we treat other people, how we our words, our actions, and how we think about what we think toward the people around us. Dallas Willard and James Bryant Smith, they point out two dominant narratives in the area of sexuality that we're tempted to buy into. One comes from our broader culture, and the other, unfortunately, comes from the church. Sadly, both are false, and both lead to frustration and to failure. Dallas Willard says this: the two main errors in the area of human sexuality are these. One, assuming that all sexual desire is good, and second, believing that all sexual desire is evil. Now let's start with the second one. This is the false narrative of the church, that all sexual desire is evil. Now this has been dominant in some Christian circles in one form or another since like the beginning of church history. This is the view that says that sex or sexual desire is inherently sinful. And there are lots of writers, even early church kind of people writers, that you can trace this belief to. Probably the best example of this, maybe the most prominent, is from the otherwise brilliant and influential writer, St. Augustine. Not St. Augustine, St. Augustine. Say it however you want. St. Augustine, writing in the 4th and 5th centuries, he believed that sexual desire itself was sinful. He even said that sex transmits, this is a theological claim here, original sin, but that therefore it was inherently sinful. St. Augustine wrestled with lust throughout his life, which is quite clear when you read his autobiographical confessions. Augustine once prayed, something felt wrong, he once prayed, "Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." That's actually pretty good, isn't it? That is refreshingly honest. You can see his inner conflict. But he adopted the narrative eventually that sexual desire is bad, that complete celibacy, that celibacy is good. Now, over the centuries, this posture made its way into the water in various Christian streams and traditions, both Catholic and Protestant. And I could give lots of examples how this thinking, this assumption shows up today. Probably shows up most commonly today in the fact that in many churches there's just a lot of silence on this subject. That it's essentially almost taboo. The problem is by refusing to address sexuality, we can actually imply without meaning to this, that it's sinful or shameful. And maybe for some of you, depending on your church background and how you're raised or what you were taught about this, I mean, some of us have messages of guilt and shame and fear and legalism just drilled into our heads about this. And the thing is, nobody wants to be cajoled. Is that a word? Nobody wants to be morally like policed into living, behaving a certain way. Those approaches don't actually work. Now, the other false narrative that we are constantly exposed to is the one from our culture, from the world around us, is that all sexual desire is good. That sex is purely a natural act. And so you might as well have as much as you want. And we see this clearly all around. You don't have to, I mean, TV, movies, where the majority of sexual activity occurs outside of marriage. But the implicit narrative that you pick up on is that the good life is the kind of lust-filled, sexually free, sexually liberated life, that's where it's found. If that's not your experience, you are missing out. Which is why, I mean, in many ways, you can make a case that things that would have formerly shocked us don't even register, right? I mean, I think we have, at some level, in many ways, become desensitized in this area. Here's a movie I bet you haven't seen. You ready? The one where the middle-aged couple has kind of had a decent marriage spanning a couple decades. They've got an average bodies. They have an average sex life. And they're just trying to figure out how to stay committed and improve their marriage. Have you guys seen that one? I have not seen that. I think that's interesting, huh? Okay, well. Now, about the only restriction on sexual behavior today in our broader culture is that we must not ever harm or take advantage of another person. That sexual activity must always be consensual, which, by the way, that is true. Absolutely true. But beyond this, the dominant narrative all around us is if people want something, it's acceptable. Now, how do these narratives become so prevalent? Actually, both contain a bit of truth, don't they? as do most false narratives. There's often truth in there. I mean, yes, sexual desire leads people to behaviors they regret, but it's wrong to blame the desire itself. We don't say food is evil because it leads some people to gluttony, right? We don't say, you know, thirst is evil because it leads some to drunkenness. And I think our culture's narrative also contains some truth. I think that sexual desire at its core is indeed good, that it was designed by God. But that doesn't mean that there are no boundaries. Just because something is natural, it doesn't mean that every expression is right or good. So not all sexual desires and expressions are good, and not all are bad. Now, maybe you're here and you're not a Christian, or someone brought you here today, and you might be thinking, this is nonsense. This is exactly what's wrong with the church. It's asserting an unenlightened view of sexuality. I mean, as long as it's loving or at least consenting between adults, I mean, what could be wrong with it? So let me just say this. I'm not here to coerce you or drive you somewhere you don't want to go. My heart is to show you that there is no better way of living out our sexuality than the way of Jesus. And that the church can't afford to be silent about this, like the most talked about, watched, and exploited subject in our entire culture. Jesus knew how important our sexuality is, how it can enhance or even destroy life. Now, in Jesus' day, adultery was defined as sexual contact between two people, one of them was married, who were not married to each other. We get that. The difference between Jesus' day and our day is that back then, adultery was almost exclusively applied to women, or at least the consequences. A man, even a married man, could get away with having sex with another woman, including slaves or prostitutes, and people generally, except for like the Pharisees, people generally looked the other way. But a woman was allowed to have sex with her husband alone, and that was what got enforced. You actually see this show up in the Gospels in John 8 with the woman caught in adultery, right? They're ready to stone her, and it raises a really interesting question. Where's the guy? Oh, never mind about him. We caught her. Besides, it's her fault. So that was the mentality. And Jesus says, no, no, no. If a man, I think that's why he's kind of being extra specific here. If a man looks at a woman lustfully, he's already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, the word that Jesus uses here for lust is the word epithumia. And that has a very specific meaning. That doesn't refer to, in other words, like ordinary sexual desire or attraction. It refers to intentionally objectifying another person for one's own gratification. So it goes beyond attraction, and instead it's cultivating sexual desire for the sake of the feeling itself. Do you see the difference between those? Dallas Willard, he paraphrases what Jesus is saying this way, saying that those who look upon a woman for the purpose of lusting for her, using her visual presence as a means of savoring the fantasized act, has thereby committed adultery with her in his heart. It's essentially objectifying or using another person. All that's missing is the overt action. So Jesus is teaching here about the difference between inner and outer righteousness. And of course, Jesus keeps getting down to what's inside of us, what's in our hearts. A good heart, according to Jesus, is free from objectification for the sake of self-gratification. He invites us into the kingdom in order to become new kinds of people, people who value and respect others. Now, we have to be really careful here to recognize that sexual desire is not wrong as a natural and uncultivated response, any more than anger as a natural and uncultivated. It happens. It's part of life, how we're wired. See, when we merely think of sex, when we see someone, or we find him or her attractive, that's not wrong. That's not what Jesus is talking about. I mean, to be tempted, what does it mean to be tempted sexually? To be tempted sexually requires that we think of sex with someone we're not married to, that we desire another person. Usually it turns out someone we see. But temptation itself isn't wrong. And again, this is where the church has sometimes, I think, messed this up. We confuse attraction, we confuse natural desires, natural appetites with sin itself, which leads to what? Shame and guilt and what is wrong with me? Once a church leader that I know, he told me this story about being out to dinner with several other prominent church leaders who happened to all be men. And these were guys who were like, who had like written books, all of them, and were, you know, had a big platform speaking nationally and these kinds of things. And well, they're having dinner, they sit down, the server comes up to the table. And I don't want to be crass or anything, but let me just say it this way. She was very attractive. Can you say that? Like, she stood out, she was noticeably attractive. Okay. I realize that, by the way, that attraction is subjective, but how about this? Whatever you just thought of. Probably that. Okay? Probably that. So, now we got our own thing. Now, my friend told me that when this happened, you know, all the guys, they're like holy, proper churchmen, right? So what they do is pretend not to notice. Like, you know, they're looking at the menu and like, just pretend like, yeah, well, I don't see anything. What? Right? And so the guy at the table who was the most well-known, the most prominent, he offered to give the blessing. And so he prays this prayer. And at the end of the prayer, he says, "And God, thank you for beautiful women." And they kind of started laughing because it was like this tension that we're all pretending to. Now, I realize that story can be taken the wrong way as creepy or gross or objectifying, and I almost didn't tell it. So, but don't take it the wrong way. He didn't mean that in any kind of objectifying or disrespectful way. See, I like that story because it reminds me of what Jesus is saying here. It's not the denial of attraction or desire. I think sometimes the Christian response or teaching is like, just go through life and pretend like you don't notice or see people or you're not attracted to anybody, you don't have any desires, and if you do, something is fundamentally wrong with you. That's not what he's saying. And that doesn't actually work. Again, the wording here refers to looking at a person with the purpose of desiring them. That is, we desire to desire. It's actively indulging, it's actively cultivating desiring because we enjoy fantasizing about sex with the person seen. In other words, desiring sex is the purpose for which we are looking in the first place. And for many of us, unfortunately, this has become a habit, a chosen habit, something that maybe we don't even realize anymore that we're doing. But I just want to say it's not something that happens to us out of our control. We're not unwilling victims without any choice. Maybe it is a habit, but at some point, the desire is embraced and indulged and elaborated and fantasized. And Jesus is saying that that is actually evidence that something is off in our souls. You guys with me so far? Okay. Now, we come to a teaching like this, and this is the way that I was taught this. We come to this teaching, and we assume that Jesus is just raising the bar. You've heard it said, but I tell you. Moses told you this. Here's the commandment. I'm here to give you version 2.0. You thought you had it easy with the commandment, but not so fast. You know, that's sort of how I was taught to read this, and that is not at all what Jesus is doing. Anybody else taught to read it this way? I'm feeling lonely. Okay, that's okay. I know. Now, here's the key. Right before these two examples, the one last week about anger and contempt, and the one this week about sex, right before these examples, Jesus says something really, really important that we usually only read isolated out of context. Here's what he says before these examples. Jesus says, "Do not think I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So that sets us down the path that he's given us 2.0. It's going to be a lot harder, more difficult. He's raising the bar. Again, that's not what he's doing. Many of us have been taught, well, look at the Pharisees. Look at their standard. They obeyed all the laws perfectly. They had laws about the law, so they wouldn't accidentally even get close to breaking a law. So reading it that way, we think that Jesus is making life more difficult. Or he's putting the bar up here, and this is how most of us read this, so why even try? Point is, accept forgiveness, accept grace, nothing you can do about it, it's too hard. Again, that's not what Jesus is saying. The key is to understand two things. First, when Jesus says he's not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it, that simply means he's come to point out. He's come to reveal what the law was trying to accomplish all along. All he's trying to do is say, this is the real goal. This was where this was trying to get you from the beginning, in its origin even. And then to illustrate what it looks like, what does it look like when this thing is like, what's it supposed to look like? As an example, he goes to, point two, the Pharisees and says, it has to look differently than them. And here's what he means. He says that what he's saying is that the Pharisees, for them, the law was all about externals. All about external, did I do the right thing or not? And he's saying that's a bad standard to follow. He says the way they look at the law, it's simply, have I obeyed the law or not? Have I murdered anybody? Have I committed adultery? If not, I'm good. And Jesus is saying that's not ever what it was supposed to be about. You've missed the point. The point was never just outward behavior. Because if you've never murdered someone, yet you treat your brother or sister with contempt, see, you've missed the point. If you've never committed adultery, but yet you walk around and you cultivate this inner thought life and this kind of this indulging and this leering and this lust, you're guilty. See, when Jesus quotes the law, and we need to kind of change how we hear this, when he says, you have heard it said, but I tell you, he's not doubling down. He's not doubling down and making it harder. He's coming in as the expert on what the thing really meant in the first place, which, by the way, is a little bit offensive to people whose jobs it is to say what that meant. He's coming in and he's saying, this is the intent. Let me explain to you what this is really about. He's showing us what a righteousness that fulfills the law, which, by the way, is then going to be something that goes deeper or beyond the righteousness, external righteousness of the Pharisees. And then he gives examples. And he gives the one about anger and murder, and then this one. He's trying to get down to our heart and our core and our character, which, by the way, is the place where all of our actions originate and flow out of in the first place. Now, at this point, so is everybody with me on this so far? Because it's going to get just a tiny bit harder. At this point, Jesus says something pretty extreme. So we saw that part. He says, if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for the whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off, throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. What do we do with that? This is the one when you skip over, right? That sounds really intense. Again, that sounds like Jesus is taking the standard of the day, the Pharisees' deal, and making it 1,000 times more difficult. By the way, reading this passage, there have been men, even whole groups of men who've gone, I don't want to have to gouge out my eye. So they made it their strategy to not look at a woman for years. So not even their own mother or sister, because, you know, I mean, they wouldn't allow themselves to be in the company of a woman or to see one under any circumstance. Just seclude yourself and avoid any situations where a woman is visible. Can you see how that comes out of the narrative that says that the desire, sexual desire, is bad? Yes, right? That's basically an attempt, interestingly, to do what Jesus says here and maybe like with less pain involved. I don't want to gouge out my eye. I'll just avoid temptation. My question is, wouldn't that solve the problem? Wouldn't that enable you to conform if what Jesus is doing is giving us 2.0 and making it harder? Wouldn't that sort of enable you to conform to Jesus' standard here? And if you don't see a woman ever, then you can't lust and cultivate desire and so on. Another Christian approach has been to say, I know, I'll train myself to hate women. Because if I despise them, I won't then be tempted to desire them. Yeah. I mean, these have been honest attempts to live out this teaching. Hopefully you can see how distorted that is. And how does any of that constitute a loving relationship toward women, not least those in your own family? Obviously not. Here's the real problem with this. Historically, these kinds of solutions and trying to work this out, that gets pretty close to regarding women as what? The problem. Or as even worse, inherently evil. I mean, yes, there are times, to be clear, when man or woman, you should just run from temptation. Is that a permanent solution? Does that get down to change your heart? No, it doesn't. Proper Victorians supposedly covered up the legs of their tables lest they lead to impure thoughts. So I don't want to cause anyone to stumble here. So, isn't that almost worse? That's interesting. I'm going to throw out something kind of crazy here and suggest that tables aren't the problem. Okay? Besides, does doing these things make me right or pure sexually? And is this the kind of life, is this the life of the kingdom that Jesus is inviting us into? Now, a more modern way of reading this, I'm going to say something controversial here, okay? Feel free to disagree. I might be wrong. I might change my mind tomorrow, but as always, feel free to disagree, okay? We read this, and sometimes we don't do the, like, go live in a cave and do all these other things. Sometimes, a more modern response to this is, ladies, you don't want us guys to have to gouge out our eyes now, do you? So can you dress more modestly? Presumably, has anybody heard this? Presumably, like longer, looser clothes. And I'm not saying, I want to be clear, that there's no line between decency and whatever the opposite is, applied, by the way, to men and women, although we usually only apply it to women. But not saying there's no line. I am saying that it is true that by definition, modesty is actually subjective, that it varies from culture to culture and place to place and time to time. There was a time, not that long ago, when they had what they called bathing machines that enabled one to change into scandalous bathing costumes such as these and step down into the water inconspicuously. In other places today, and please hear me, I mean no disrespect by this at all. In other places today, anything less than this is considered immodest or even scandalous. So my question is, who gets to decide the standard? And all I'm saying is somewhere in here, especially in the church, we have this culture of modesty thing. There's a line that we can cross, and I think it's very subtle, where we make women the problem. And I'm not critiquing anyone's personal convictions in this area of modesty and dress. I mean, that's your thing, and no critique of that at all. What I am saying is, if we go down the path where what you wear is the problem, guess who needs to fix that? I need you to fix that. And my question is, what happens if you do all the things within reason to fix that and I still have a problem? Like I still can't control my thoughts. What then? What I'm trying to say is, when do I get to gouge out my eyes? Okay? Okay. That was the part that, you know, do what you want with that. I've never heard anybody talk about this in church, have you? So that's probably because it's wrong. Anyway, anyway, what I'm saying, I'm suggesting that all of that and these approaches to live this out, we're taking this the complete wrong way. What Jesus is addressing is the attempt to solve the problem of right sexual behavior with any law or laws that govern those behaviors. Jesus is saying that doesn't work. The mistake of the Pharisees was trying to control the act instead of changing the heart. And what Jesus is doing here is absolutely brilliant. What he's doing is continuing their own argument, and he's now using it against them. He's saying, if you think that laws can eliminate your being wrong, he's saying, to be consistent, wouldn't you just cut off your hand or gouge out your eye, and that way you couldn't possibly do the acts that the law forbids? He's being facetious. He's not being literal. Jesus had a sense of humor. Is that even allowed? Here's what he's saying. If it's all about the act, well, then I have a good idea. Why don't you just blind yourself, right? That way you could never be tempted to adultery, or you'd never be tempted to act because you can't see in the first place. Or even better yet, he's saying, why don't you dismember yourself? If you do that sufficiently, then you won't be able to do any wrong action. Just take the possibility off the table and your problem is solved. He's not being literal. He's demonstrating that the logic of the scribes and Pharisees is ridiculous, is absurd. He's actually using a very well-known, at the time, Greek and Roman rhetorical device called reductio ad absurdum. It means to reduce something to absurdity. This is a way of making a point by taking your opponent's argument to the logical conclusion and showing how silly it is. It's like that thing you do when you're a kid and you really want something, your parents say no, and then you come up with the best, most ironclad argument for your position that you can possibly think of, which is, well, all my friends are doing it, and your parents recognize the logical absurdity of that line of thinking, and what every parent in the universe has said at some point is, well, if all your friends jumped off a bridge or cliff, would you do the same thing? See, parent, if you said that as a parent, you didn't know it. You're a Greek philosopher. And that is exactly what Jesus is doing. He's pointing out the Pharisees' view, which was the law could be satisfied and thus goodness attained if you simply avoided the wrong, sinful action. You're right when you've done nothing wrong, they said. And he starts with that and takes it to its logical conclusion. It shows how ridiculous their thinking is. He says, if that's how it works, you could avoid even the possibility. He's kind of calling their bluff, right? You could avoid the entire possibility, eliminate body parts that make sinful actions possible. Think about it. You could just kind of roll into heaven as a mutilated stump, right? Perfect. That's what he's saying. That's borrowing a phrase from Dallas Willard, by the way. He's not saying cut off your hand or gouge out your eye. He's saying if you take it to its extreme, this obsession with externals, that's where it goes. But it solves nothing. And there's no advantage gained before God because the mutilated stump can still have a wicked heart. See, the religious approach tends to focus on what did you do? Or even what can you do? Jesus is getting at the heart. What would you do if you could? That gets down to our hearts, our character, and eliminating body parts doesn't change how we answer that question. If you dismember your body to the point where you could never murder or even look hatefully at another person, never commit adultery or even look to lust, your heart can still be full of anger and contempt and lust, no matter how thoroughly we try to suppress or stifle it. Because the problem isn't your hand or your eye. Where's the problem? Your heart. Jesus says, for it is from within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person. The goodness of the kingdom heart, by contrast, is the positive love of God and those around us that fills our hearts and crowds out these many forms of evil. From that goodness comes deeds of respect and purity that characterize sexuality as it was meant by God to be. My question is, what does Jesus know about all this? What does he know about our sexuality that perhaps we don't? I think for one, Jesus recognizes that God has put our sexuality at the very center and core of our lives and our being. It's tied to our hearts. It's tied to our souls, meaning it cannot be reduced to a mere transaction between people. And that's it. I don't know if you know this, but the word sex comes from the Latin verb sicare. And sicare means literally to sever, to amputate, cut off from the whole. And every time I think about that, I think that means the opposite of what I think it should mean. Can you see that? That's all I'll say. To give an example of this, just track with me here. To give an example, if you took a chainsaw and cut a branch off of a tree, you could say that you sexed, that branch, okay? This branch, if it could feel, would wake up lying on the cold ground, right? Disconnected, a lonely branch disconnected from what was once, you know, once part of a great organism. This branch would know that in every cell, if it wants to keep living, especially if it wants to bear fruit and produce flowers, it has to somehow get reconnected to the tree. And that's pretty much how we come into the world. We wake up in our cribs, not at home in the world, but crying, right? Lonely, cut off, severed from the great whole. And so our sexuality at its root is the awareness that we've been cut off, severed, separated from someone or something. And we wake up in the world, and in every cell of our being, we ache, consciously or unconsciously, sensing that we're incomplete or lonely. Like we're like a little piece of something that was once part of a great whole. According to the Bible, one of the first consequences of sin in the garden was a disruption of intimacy between God and each other. Shame entered into the story, and intimacy was lost. And so I think Jesus understands that our sexual impulses, they drive us to unite, they drive us to restore somehow this union that's been severed, that it points to a deeper longing, a union with the God who created us, to a longing for connection with each other, to know and be fully known. And even the origins of the word sex remind us that deep down we are looking for something deeper. We're looking for something. I think Jesus, the reason he takes the topic of sex and gets down not just actions, not just thoughts, but our hearts in relationship to him is because he knows that's the only place we're going to find what we're looking for. Because he knows that our sexuality encompasses far more than simply sex. That our sexuality and having sex are not the same thing. Sexuality is an all-encompassing energy inside of us. You go back to Genesis where God says it's not good for man to be alone. Sexuality is this great drive within us for love, communion, community, friendship, family, wholeness, creativity, and joy. Our sexuality at its most fundamental level is this energy inside of us that works incessantly against our being alone. It's this beautiful, good, powerful, sacred energy given to us by God. It's experienced in every cell of our being as an irrepressible urge to overcome our incompleteness. Sex, on the other hand, is only one aspect of this much larger reality, albeit a very important one. See, when our culture collapses sexuality into sex, one and the same, a tragic reduction occurs. Sexuality is a wide energy. We're healthy sexually when we have love, community, family, friendship, affection, creativity, and joy. Which means that a person can have lots of sex and still be lacking all these things in a profound way. Still lack a sense of wholeness and connection with God and with other people. It also means a person can be celibate and experience all of this in a profound, significant way. Philip Yancey says that when a society loses faith in its gods or God, lesser powers arise to take their place. Blocked longings seek new routes. Every man who knocks on the door of a brothel is looking for God, said G.K. Chesterton. In modern Europe and in the U.S., sex has a near sacred quality of mythic, numinous power, We select our sexiest individuals and accord them with the status of gods and goddesses, fawning over the details of their lives, broadcasting their bodily statistics, surrounding them with paparazzi, rewarding them with money and status. Sex no longer points to something beyond. It becomes the thing itself, the substitute sacred. Isn't that true? That when God is removed, it's not that we stop worshiping, we just worship something else. He goes on and he says, the pain that lingers after sexual failure is oddly an indirect proof of sexuality's original design. Those who test that design and fail in the process gain some haunting sense of what we are missing. We want desperately to connect, to grow in personal intimacy, even as we progress in sexual intimacy. We want to be fully known and fully loved. When that does not happen, or when the fragile link snaps, it simply proves that in sex, as in every area of life, fallen humanity gets in the way and keeps us from realizing the ideal. See, we have this spiritual hunger in our souls, and we can't escape it. And unfortunately, in our culture, we just keep like hammering the sex button, hoping to get it satisfied, but it doesn't work. Jesus isn't giving us a new morality. He's not taking the old thing and making it version 2.0, more difficult. He's not saying, I want to ruin all of your fun. He's saying, what are you hoping to find? Paul says in 1 Corinthians, flee from sexual immorality. All other sins people commit are outside their bodies. But those who sin sexually sin against their own bodies. Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? Again, almost every other religion is based on externals, external morality, external religion. Jesus makes the shocking claim, or Paul makes the shocking claim here, that it's not a temple that you go to meet God. We've actually become the temple. Most of us, if we're honest, we don't want God that close. Like, I want a little more distance. How about the priest do the celibate thing and whatever, work all that out, and I'll just go to him for confession. A little distance, right? I don't want God like inside my life. When Paul here says that all other sins people commit are outside their bodies, but those who sin sexually sin against their own bodies, what he's saying is that what we do with our sexuality, it's connected to the kinds of people we're becoming. That's exactly what Jesus is getting at. Not just with sex, not just with our action, but with lust, our thoughts, indulging in the desire to desire, because we think we're going to get something fulfilled. That actually begins shaping who we are. When it comes to the intimacy your soul craves, what this means is you don't have to look externally to meet the deep longings of your heart. Those cries of your heart that you think will only be met by being with another person externally. It means you have these longings in you that are met by God, that you are the temple, that Christ is present by his Spirit, enabling us to control our thoughts and our bodies. That staying connected to him, the Holy Spirit, by the way, the fruit of the Spirit, one of them is self-control. That we, in connection to the Spirit, get new desires, a new heart, the ability to say yes to things that are life-giving. For a Christian, sex is something sacred. It can never be casual or neutral or unimportant, no matter how much our culture protests. See, the reason Jesus teaches that sex must be linked to marriage, to monogamy, to a covenant commitment, is because he knows that by definition, sex speaks of a total giving, a total trust, a total commitment. It's more than body. It implicates emotions. It's the mingling of souls, as one author put it. He knows that outside of this commitment and trust, sex is partly a lie. It's promising to give a gift you can't really give. It's asking for a gift you can't really reciprocate. So I just want to ask you to think very carefully about your habits and your patterns and your thoughts and your choices with regard to your sexuality. The question is, does this behavior, does this pattern of thought, Does this action, does it create obstacles for future healthy intimacy? Does this limit the possibility of long-term, faithful, loving relationship? Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for this life that you're inviting us into. So easy for us to reduce our relationship with you to Sunday or to a few principles or morals or whatever, but you've got a much bigger plan. It encompasses the in total our lives, all of us and all of who we are. Lord, help us to honor you with our bodies, with our thoughts, with our choices. Lord, for some of us who we just got stuck in these ruts, either thought patterns or behaviors, pray that you'd bring new life. And maybe it starts with recognizing that this whole time we thought we were going to find life in a place where it's not where it is. Help us just to maybe recognize that some of these things simply do not deliver what they promise. Maybe we could start there. Lord, that you would begin to replace these false narratives and assumptions in our lives with the truth. Lord, help us to grow in our relationships with you, our relationships with one another. We could see people the way that you see people. That's such a huge part of this. We could love people the way that you love them. So give us the strength, give us the courage, the power to do this. Thank you for the life and the death, the sacrifice of your son, Jesus, and the life that he invites us into today. It's in his strong name we pray. Amen. Well, thank you for worshiping with us. As you leave this morning, I want to just send you out with a crazy thought. Ready? That as a child of God, that God actually knows, like he really knows what's best for us. That he knows it. And that his goal isn't to take away our joy or our fun or our happiness. His goal is to give us freedom and to give us life. That just comes down to one simple thing. Will we trust that he knows? Will we trust him and follow him? So I encourage you with this stuff and with everything else to trust him. Go with him. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.